but I spent the first phase of the war in a basement, diving body and soul into all manner of books. School was closed and it was raining mortar shells. It is dreadfully boring to be in basements. My initial worries were mostly about how to fight boredom and what to read next. Footnote. Benoit Mandelbrot, who had a similar experience at about the same age, though close to four decades earlier, remembers his own war episode as long stretches of painful boredom punctuated by brief moments of extreme fear. Though being forced to read for lack of other activities is not as enjoyable as reading out of one's own volition. I wanted to be a philosopher. I still do. So I felt that I needed to make an investment by forcibly studying others' ideas. Circumstances motivated me to study theoretical and general accounts of wars and conflicts, trying to get into the guts of history, to get into the workings of that big machine that generates events. Surprisingly, the book that influenced me was not written by someone in the thinking business, but by a journalist. William Shirer's Berlin Diary, The Journal of a Foreign Correspondent, 1934 to 1941. Shirer was a radio correspondent, famous for his book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. It occurred to me that the journal offered an unusual perspective. I had already read or read about the works of Hegel, Marx, Toynbee, Aron, and Fichte on the philosophy of history and its properties, and thought that I had a vague idea of the notions of dialectics, to the extent that there was something to understand in these theories. I did not grasp much, except that history had some logic, and that things developed through contradiction, or opposites, in a way that elevated mankind into higher forms of society, that kind of thing. This sounded awfully similar to the theorizing around me about the war in Lebanon. To this day, I surprise people who put the ludicrous question to me about what books shaped my thinking by telling them that this book taught me, albeit inadvertently, the most about philosophy and theoretical history, and, we will see, about science as well, since I learned the difference between forward and backward processes. How? Simply, the diary purported to describe the events as they were taking place, not after. I was in a basement with history audibly unfolding above me. The sound of mortar shells kept me up all night. I was a teenager attending the funerals of classmates. I was experiencing a non-theoretical unfolding of history, and I was reading about someone apparently experiencing history as it went along. I made efforts to mentally produce a movie-like representation of the future and realized it was not so obvious. I realized that if I were to start writing about the events later, they would seem more historical. There was a difference between the before and the after. The journal was purportedly written without Shirer knowing what was going to happen next, when the information available to him was not corrupted by the subsequent outcomes. Some comments here and there were quite illuminating, particularly those concerning the French belief that Hitler was a transitory phenomenon, which explained their lack of preparation and subsequent rapid capitulation. At no time was the extent of the ultimate devastation deemed possible. While we have a highly unstable memory, a diary provides indelible facts recorded more or less immediately. It thus allows the fixation of an unrevised perception and enables us to later study events in their own context. Again, it is the purported method of description of the event, not its execution, that was important. In fact, it is likely that Shirer and his editors did some cheating, since the book was published in 1941, and publishers, I am told, are in the business of delivering texts to the general public instead of providing faithful depictions of the author's mindsets stripped of retrospective distortions. By cheating, I mean removing at the time of publication elements that did not turn out to be relevant to what happened, thus enhancing those that may interest the public. Indeed, the editing process can be severely distorting, particularly when the author is assigned what is called a good editor. Still, encountering Shirer's book provided me with an intuition about the workings of history. One would suppose that people living through the beginning of World War II had an inkling that something momentous was taking place. Not at all. Footnote. The historian Neil Ferguson showed that, despite all the standard accounts of the build-up to the Great War, which described mounting tensions and escalating crises, the conflict came as a surprise. Only retrospectively was it seen as unavoidable by backward-looking historians. Ferguson used a clever empirical argument to make his point. He looked at the prices of imperial bonds, which normally include investors' anticipation of government's financing needs and decline in expectation of conflicts, since wars cause severe deficits. But bond prices did not reflect the anticipation of war. Note that this study illustrates, in addition, how working with prices can provide a good understanding of history. Shirer's diary turned out to be a training program in the dynamics of uncertainty. I wanted to be a philosopher, not knowing at the time what most professional philosophers did for a living. The idea led me to adventure, rather to the adventurous practice of uncertainty, and also to mathematical and scientific pursuits instead. Education in a taxicab. I will introduce the third element of the triplet, the curse of learning, as follows. I closely watched my grandfather, who was Minister of Defense and later Minister of the Interior and Deputy Prime Minister in the early days of the war, before the fading of his political role. In spite of his position, he did not seem to know what was going to happen any more than did his driver, Mikhail. But unlike my grandfather, Mikhail used to repeat, "God knows," as his main commentary on events, transferring the task of understanding higher up. I noticed that very intelligent and informed persons were at no advantage over cab drivers in their predictions, but there was a crucial difference. Cab drivers did not believe that they understood as much as learned people. Really, they were not the experts, and they knew it. Nobody knew anything, but elite thinkers thought that they knew more than the rest because they were elite thinkers. And if you're a member of the elite, you automatically know more than the non-elite. It is not just knowledge but information that can be of dubious value. It came to my notice that almost everybody was acquainted with current events in their smallest details. The overlap between newspapers was so large that you would get less and less information the more you read. Yet everyone was so eager to become familiar with every fact that they read every freshly printed document and listened to every radio station as if the great answer was going to be revealed to them in the next bulletin. People became encyclopedias of who had met with whom and which politician said what to which other politician, and with what tone of voice. Was he more friendly than usual? Yet to no avail. Clusters. I also noticed during the Lebanese War that journalists tended to cluster not necessarily around the same opinions, but frequently around the same framework of analyses. They assign the same importance to the same sets of circumstances and cut reality into the same categories. Once again, the manifestation of Platonicity, the desire to cut reality into crisp shapes. What Robert Fisk calls hotel journalism further increased the mental contagion. While Lebanon in earlier journalism was part of the Levant, i.e., the Eastern Mediterranean, it now suddenly became a part of the Middle East, as if someone had managed to transport it closer to the sands of Saudi Arabia. The island of Cyprus, around 60 miles from my village in northern Lebanon, and with almost identical food, churches, and habits, suddenly became part of Europe. Of course, the natives on both sides became subsequently conditioned. While in the past a distinction had been drawn between Mediterranean and non-Mediterranean, i.e. between the olive oil and the butter, in the 1970s the distinction suddenly became that between Europe and non-Europe. Islam being the wedge between the two, one does not know where to place the indigenous Arab-speaking Christians, or Jews, in that story. Categorizing is necessary for humans, but it becomes pathological when the category is seen as definitive, preventing people from considering the fuzziness of boundaries, let alone revising their categories. Contagion was the culprit. If you selected 100 independent-minded journalists capable of seeing factors in isolation from one another, you would get 100 different opinions. But the process of having these people report in lockstep caused the dimensionality of the opinion set to shrink considerably. They converged on opinions and used the same items as causes. For instance, to depart from Lebanon for a moment, all reporters now refer to the Roaring Eighties, assuming that there was something particularly distinct about that exact decade. And during the internet bubble of the late 1990s, journalists agreed on crazy indicators as explanatory of the quality of worthless companies that everyone wanted very badly. Footnote: we will see in Chapter 10 some clever quantitative tests done to prove such herding. They show that, in many subject matters, the distance between opinions is remarkably narrower than the distance between the average of opinions and truth. If you want to see what I mean by the arbitrariness of categories, check the situation of polarized politics. The next time a Martian visits Earth, try to explain to him why those who favor allowing the elimination of a fetus in the mother's womb also oppose capital punishment. Or try to explain to him why those who accept abortion are supposed to be favorable to high taxation but against a strong military. Why do those who prefer sexual freedom need to be against individual economic liberty? I noticed the absurdity of clustering when I was quite young. By some farcical turn of events, in that civil war of Lebanon, Christians became pro-free market and the capitalistic system, i.e., what a journalist would call the right, and the Islamists became socialists, getting support from communist regimes. Pravda, the organ of the communist regime, called them oppression fighters, though subsequently when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, it was the Americans who sought association with bin Laden and his Muslim peers. The best way to prove the arbitrary character of these categories and the contagion effect they produce is to remember how frequently these clusters reverse in history. Today's alliance between Christian fundamentalists and the Israeli lobby would certainly seem puzzling to a 19th century intellectual. Christians used to be anti-Semites, and Muslims were the protectors of the Jews, whom they preferred to Christians. Libertarians used to be left-wing. What is interesting to me as a probabilist is that some random event makes one group that initially supports an issue ally itself with another group that supports another issue, thus causing the two items to fuse and unify, until the surprise of the separation. Categorizing always produces reduction in true complexity. It is a manifestation of the black swan generator, that unshakable platonicity that I defined in the prologue. Any reduction of the world around us can have explosive consequences, since it rules out some sources of uncertainty. It drives us to a misunderstanding of the fabric of the world. For instance, you may think that radical Islam and its values are your allies against the threat of communism, and so you may help them develop, until they send two planes into downtown Manhattan. It was a few years after the beginning of the Lebanese War, as I was attending the Wharton School at the age of 22, that I was hit with the idea of efficient markets, an idea that holds that there is no way to derive profits from traded securities since these instruments have automatically incorporated all the available information. Public information can therefore be useless, particularly to a businessman, since prices can already include all such information, and news shared with millions gives you no real advantage. Odds are that one or more of the hundreds of millions of other readers of such information will already have bought the security, thus pushing up the price. I then completely gave up reading newspapers and watching television, which freed up a considerable amount of time, say 1 hour or more a day, enough time to read more than 100 additional books per year, which, after a couple of decades, starts mounting. But this argument was not quite the entire reason for my dictum in this book to avoid the newspapers, as we will see further benefits in avoiding the toxicity of information. It was initially a great excuse to avoid keeping up with the minutiae of business, a perfect alibi since I found nothing interesting about the details of the business world, inelegant, dull, pompous, greedy, unintellectual, selfish, and boring. Where is the show? Why someone with plans to become a philosopher or a scientific philosopher of history would wind up in business school, and the Wharton School no less, still escapes me. There I saw that it was not merely some inconsequential politician in a small and antique country, and his philosophical driver, Mikhail, who did not know what was going on. After all, people in small countries are supposed to not know what is going on. What I saw was that in one of the most prestigious business schools in the world, in the most potent country in the history of the world, the executives of the most powerful corporations were coming to describe what they did for a living, and it was possible that they, too, did not know what was going on. As a matter of fact, in my mind it was far more than a possibility. I felt in my spine the weight of the epistemic arrogance of the human race. Footnote. I then realized that the great strength of the free market system is the fact that company executives don't need to know what's going on. I became obsessive. At the time, I started becoming conscious of my subject, the highly improbable consequential event. And it was not only well-dressed, testosterone-charged corporate executives who were usually fooled by this concentrated luck, but persons of great learning. This awareness turned my black swan from a problem of lucky or unlucky people in business into a problem of knowledge and science. My idea is that not only are some scientific results useless in real life because they underestimate the impact of the highly improbable, or lead us to ignore it, but that many of them may be actually creating black swans. These are not just taxonomic errors that can make you flunk a class in ornithology. I started to see the consequences of the idea. 8¾ pounds later. 4½ years after my graduation from Wharton, and 8¾ pounds heavier, on October 19, 1987, I walked home from the offices of the investment bank Credit Suisse First Boston in Midtown Manhattan to the Upper East Side. I walked slowly as I was in a bewildered state. That day saw a traumatic financial event, the largest market drop in modern history. It was all the more traumatic in that it took place at a time when we thought we had become sufficiently sophisticated with all these intelligent-talking, platonified economists with their phony bell curve-based equations to prevent, or at least forecast and control, big shocks. The drop was not even the response to any discernible news. The occurrence of the event lay outside anything one could have imagined on the previous day. Had I pointed out its possibility, I would have been called a lunatic. It qualified as a black swan, but I did not know the expression then. I ran into a colleague of mine, Demetrius, on Park Avenue, and as I started talking to him, an anxiety-ridden woman, losing all inhibitions, jumped into the conversation. "Hey, do the two of you know what's going on?" People on the sidewalk looked dazed. Earlier I had seen a few adults silently sobbing in the trading room of First Boston. I had spent the day at the epicenter of the events, with shell-shocked people running around like rabbits in front of headlights. When I got home, my cousin Alexis called to tell me that his neighbor committed suicide, jumping from his upper-floor apartment. It did not even feel eerie. It felt like Lebanon, with a twist. Having seen both, I was struck that financial distress could be more demoralizing than war. Just consider that financial problems and the accompanying humiliations can lead to suicide, but war doesn't appear to do so directly. I feared a Pyrrhic victory. I had been vindicated intellectually, but I was afraid of being too right and seeing the system crumble under my feet. I did not really want to be that right. I will always remember the late Jimmy P., who, seeing his net worth in the process of melting down, kept half-jokingly begging the price on the screen to stop moving. But I realized then and there that I did not give a hoot about the money. I experienced the strangest feeling I have ever had in my life, this deafening trumpet signaling to me that I was right, so loudly that it made my bones vibrate. I have never had it since and will never be able to explain it to those who have never experienced it. It was a physical sensation, perhaps a mixture of joy, pride, and terror. And I felt vindicated? How? During the 1 or 2 years after my arrival at Wharton, I had developed a precise but strange specialty, betting on rare and unexpected events, those that were on the Platonic fold and considered inconceivable by the Platonic experts. Recall that the Platonic fold is where our representation of reality ceases to apply, but we do not know it. For I was early to embrace, as a day job, the profession of quantitative finance. I became a quant and trader at the same time. A quant is a brand of industrial scientist who applies mathematical models of uncertainty to financial or socioeconomic data and complex financial instruments. Except that I was a quant exactly in reverse. I studied the flaws and the limits of these models, looking for the Platonic fold where they break down. Also, I engaged in speculative trading, not just talk, which was rare for quants since they were prevented from taking risks, their role being confined to analysis, not decision-making. I was convinced that I was totally incompetent in predicting market prices, but that others were generally incompetent also but did not know it, or did not know that they were taking massive risks. Most traders were just picking pennies in front of a steamroller, exposing themselves to the high-impact rare event, yet sleeping like babies, unaware of it. Mine was the only job you could do if you thought of yourself as risk-hating, risk-aware, and highly ignorant. Also, the technical baggage that comes with being a quant, a mixture of applied mathematics, engineering, and statistics, in addition to the immersion in practice, turned out to be very useful for someone wanting to be a philosopher. Footnote. I specialized in complicated financial instruments called derivatives, those that required advanced mathematics, but for which the errors for using the wrong mathematics were the greatest. The subject was new and attractive enough for me to get a doctorate in it. Note that I was not able to build a career just by betting on black swans. There were not enough tradable opportunities. I could, on the other hand, avoid being exposed to them by protecting my portfolio against large losses. So, in order to eliminate the dependence on randomness, I focused on technical inefficiencies between complicated instruments and on exploiting these opportunities without exposure to the rare event, before they disappeared as my competitors became technologically advanced. Later on in my career, I discovered the easier and less randomness-laden business of protecting, insurance-style, large portfolios against the black swan. First, when you spend a couple of decades doing mass-scale empirical work with data and taking risks based on such studies, you can easily spot elements in the texture of the world that the Platonified thinker is too brainwashed or threatened to see. Second, it allowed me to become formal and systematic in my thinking instead of wallowing in the anecdotal. Finally, both the philosophy of history and epistemology, the philosophy of knowledge, seemed inseparable from the empirical study of time series data, which is a succession of numbers in time, a sort of historical document containing numbers instead of words. And numbers are easy to process on computers. Studying historical data makes you conscious that history runs forward, not backward, and that it is messier than narrated accounts. Epistemology, the philosophy of history, and statistics aim at understanding truths, investigating the mechanisms that generate them, and separating regularity from the coincidental in historical matters. They all address the question of what one knows, except that they are all to be found in different buildings, so to speak. The four-letter word of independence. That night on October 19, 1987, I slept for 12 hours straight. It was hard to tell my friends, all hurt in some manner by the crash, about this feeling of vindication. Bonuses at the time were a fraction of what they are today, but if my employer, First Boston, and the financial system survived until year-end, I would get the equivalent of a fellowship. This is sometimes called FU money, which, in spite of its coarseness, means that it allows you to act like a Victorian gentleman, free from slavery. It is a psychological buffer, The capital is not so large as to make you spoiled rich, but large enough to give you the freedom to choose a new occupation without excessive consideration of the financial rewards. It shields you from prostituting your mind and frees you from outside authority, any outside authority. Independence is person-specific. I have always been taken aback at the high number of people in whom an astonishingly high income led to additional sycophancy as they became more dependent on their clients and employers and more addicted to making even more money. While not substantial by some standards, it literally cured me of all financial ambition. It made me feel ashamed whenever I diverted time away from study for the pursuit of material wealth. Note that the designation FU corresponds to the exhilarating ability to pronounce that compact phrase before hanging up the phone. These were the days when it was extremely common for traders to break phones when they lost money. Some resorted to destroying chairs, tables, or whatever would make noise. Once, in the Chicago pits, another trader tried to strangle me, and it took four security guards to drag him away. He was irate because I was standing in what he deemed his territory. Who would want to leave such an environment? Compare it to lunches in a drab university cafeteria with gentle-mannered professors discussing the latest departmental intrigue. So I stayed in the quant and trading business. I'm still there, but organized myself to do minimal but intense and entertaining work. Focus only on the most technical aspects. Never attend business meetings. Avoid the company of achievers and people in suits who don't read books. And take a sabbatical year for every three on average to fill up gaps in my scientific and philosophical culture. To slowly distill my single idea, I wanted to become a flaneur, a professional meditator, sit in cafes, lounge, unglued to desks and organization structures, sleep as long as I needed, read voraciously, and not owe any explanation to anybody. I wanted to be left alone in order to build, small steps at a time, an entire system of thought based on my black swan idea. Limousine philosopher. The war in Lebanon and the crash of 1987 seemed identical phenomena. It became obvious to me that nearly everyone had a mental blind spot in acknowledging the role of such events. It was as if they were not able to see these mammoths, or that they rapidly forgot about them. The answer was looking straight at me. It was a psychological, perhaps even biological, blindness. The problem lay not in the nature of events, but in the way we perceived them. I end this autobiographical prelude with the following story. I had no defined specialty outside of my day job and wanted none. When people at cocktail parties asked me what I did for a living, I was tempted to answer, "I am a skeptical empiricist and a flaneur reader, someone committed to getting very deep into an idea." But I made things simple by saying that I was a limousine driver. Once, on a transatlantic flight, I found myself upgraded to first class next to an expensively dressed, high-powered lady dripping with gold and jewelry who continuously ate nuts, low-carb diet perhaps, insisted on drinking only Evian, all the while reading the European edition of the Wall Street Journal. She kept trying to start a conversation in broken French, since she saw me reading a book in French by the sociologist-philosopher Pierre Bourdieu, which, ironically, dealt with the marks of social distinction. I informed her, in English, that I was a limousine driver, proudly insisting that I only drove very upper-end cars. An icy silence lasted the whole flight, and, although I could feel the tension, it allowed me to read in peace. Chapter 2. Yevgenia's Black Swan. Pink glasses and success. How Yevgenia stops marrying philosophers. I told you so. 5 years ago, Yevgenia Nikolaevna Krasnova was an obscure and unpublished novelist with an unusual background. She was a neuroscientist with an interest in philosophy. Her first three husbands had been philosophers, and she got it into her stubborn Franco-Russian head to express her research and ideas in literary form. She dressed up her theories as stories and mixed them with all manner of autobiographical commentary. She avoided the journalistic prevarications of contemporary narrative nonfiction. On a clear April morning, John Smith left his house. Foreign dialogue was always written in the original language, with translations appended like movie subtitles. She refused to dub into bad English conversations that took place in bad Italian. Footnote: her third husband was an Italian philosopher. No publisher would have given her the time of day, except that there was, at the time, some interest in those rare scientists who could manage to express themselves in semi-understandable sentences. A few publishers agreed to speak with her. They hoped that she would grow up and write a popular science book on consciousness. She received enough attention to get the courtesy of rejection letters and occasional insulting comments instead of the far more insulting and demeaning silence. Publishers were confused by her manuscript. She could not even answer their first question, "Is this fiction or nonfiction?" Nor could she respond to the, "Who is this book written for?" on the publisher's book proposal forms. She was told, "You need to understand who your audience is," and, "Amateurs write for themselves, professionals write for others." She was also told to conform to a precise genre because bookstores do not like to be confused and need to know where to place a book on the shelves. One editor protectively added, "This, my dear friend, will only sell 10 copies, including those bought by your ex-husbands and family members." She had attended a famous writing workshop 5 years earlier and came out nauseated. Writing well seemed to mean obeying arbitrary rules that had grown into gospel, with a confirmatory reinforcement of what we call experience. The writers she met were learning to retrofit what was deemed successful. They all tried to imitate stories that had appeared in past issues of The New Yorker, not realizing that most of what is new, by definition, cannot be modeled on past issues of The New Yorker. Even the idea of a short story was a Me Too concept to Yevgenia. The workshop instructor, gentle but firm in his delivery, told her that her case was utterly hopeless. Yevgenia ended up posting the entire manuscript of her main book, A Story of Recursion, on the web. There it found a small audience, which included the shrewd owner of a small unknown publishing house, who wore pink-rimmed glasses and spoke primitive Russian, convinced that he was fluent. He offered to publish her and agreed to her condition to keep her text completely unedited. He offered her a fraction of the standard royalty rate in return for her editorial stricture. He had so little to lose. She accepted, since she had no choice. It took 5 years for Yevgenia to graduate from the egomaniac without anything to justify it, stubborn and difficult to deal with category, to persevering, resolute, painstaking, and fiercely independent. For her book slowly caught fire, becoming one of the great and strange successes in literary history, selling millions of copies and drawing so-called critical acclaim. The startup house has since become a big corporation, with a polite receptionist to greet visitors as they enter the main office. Her book has been translated into 40 languages, even French. You see her picture everywhere. She is said to be the pioneer of something called the Consilience School. Publishers now have a theory that truck drivers who read books do not read books written for truck drivers, and hold that readers despise writers who pander to them. A scientific paper, it is now understood, can hide trivialities or irrelevance with equations and jargon. Consilient prose, by exposing an idea in raw form, allows it to be judged by the public. Today, Yevgenia has stopped marrying philosophers. They argue too much, and she hides from the press. In classrooms, literary scholars discuss the many clues indicating the inevitability of the new style. The distinction between fiction and nonfiction is considered too archaic to withstand the challenges of modern society. It was so evident that we needed to remedy the fragmentation between art and science. After the fact, her talent was so obvious. Many of the editors she later met blamed her for not coming to them, convinced that they would have immediately seen the merit in her work. In a few years, a literary scholar will write the essay, "From Kundera to Krasnova, showing how the seeds of her work can be found in Kundera, a precursor who mixed essay and meta-commentary. Yevgenia never read Kundera, but did see the movie version of one of his books. There was no commentary in the movie. A prominent scholar will show how the influence of Gregory Bateson, who injected autobiographical scenes into his scholarly research papers, is visible on every page. Yevgenia has never heard of Bateson. Yevgenia's book is a black swan. Chapter 3. The Speculator and the Prostitute. On the critical difference between speculators and prostitutes. Fairness, unfairness, and black swans. Theory of knowledge and professional incomes. How Extremistan is not the best place to visit, except perhaps if you are a winner. Yevgenia's rise from the second basement to superstar is possible in only one environment, which I call Extremistan. Footnote. To those listeners who Googled Yevgenia Krasnova, I am sorry to say that she is officially a fictional character. I will soon introduce the central distinction between the black swan-generating province of Extremistan and the tame, quiet, and uneventful province of Mediocristan. The best, worst, advice. When I play back in my mind all the advice people have given me, I see that only a couple of ideas have stuck with me for life. The rest have been mere words, and I am glad that I did not heed most of it. Most consisted of recommendations such as, be measured and reasonable in your statements, contradicting the black swan idea, since empirical reality is not measured, and its own version of reasonableness does not correspond to the conventional middlebrow definition. To be genuinely empirical is to reflect reality as faithfully as possible. To be honorable implies not fearing the appearance and consequences of being outlandish. The next time someone pesters you with unneeded advice, gently remind him of the fate of the monk whom Ivan the Terrible put to death for delivering uninvited and moralizing advice. It works as a short-term cure. The most important piece of advice was, in retrospect, bad, but it was also, paradoxically, the most consequential, as it pushed me deeper into the dynamics of the black swan. It came when I was 22, one February afternoon, in the corridor of a building at 3400 Walnut Street in Philadelphia, where I lived. A second-year Wharton student told me to get a profession that is scalable, that is, one in which you are not paid by the hour and thus subject to the limitations of the amount of your labor. It was a very simple way to discriminate among professions and, from that, to generalize a separation between types of uncertainty. And it led me to the major philosophical problem, the problem of induction, which is the technical name for the black swan. It allowed me to turn the black swan from a logical impasse into an easy-to-implement solution and, as we will see in the next chapters, to ground it in the texture of empirical reality. How did career advice lead to such ideas about the nature of uncertainty? Some professions, such as dentists, consultants, or massage professionals, cannot be scaled. There is a cap on the number of patients or clients you can see in a given period of time. If you are a prostitute, you work by the hour and are generally paid by the hour. Furthermore, your presence is, I assume, necessary for the service you provide. If you open a fancy restaurant, you will at best steadily fill up the room, unless you franchise it. In these professions, no matter how highly paid, your income is subject to gravity. Your revenue depends on your continuous efforts more than on the quality of your decisions. Moreover, this kind of work is largely predictable. It will vary, but not to the point of making the income of a single day more significant than that of the rest of your life. In other words, it will not be black swan-driven. Yevgenia Nikolaevna would not have been able to cross the chasm between underdog and supreme hero overnight had she been a tax accountant or a hernia specialist, but she would not have been an underdog either. Other professions allow you to add zeros to your output and your income, if you do well, at little or no extra effort. Now, being lazy, considering laziness as an asset, and eager to free up the maximum amount of time in my day to meditate and read, I immediately, but mistakenly, drew a conclusion. I separated the idea person who sells an intellectual product in the form of a transaction or a piece of work from the labor person who sells you his work. If you are an idea person, you do not have to work hard, only think intensely. You do the same work whether you produce 100 units or 1,000. In quant trading, the same amount of work is involved in buying 100 shares as in buying 100,000, or even 1,000,000. It is the same phone call, the same computation, the same legal document, the same expenditure of brain cells, the same effort in verifying that the transaction is right. Furthermore, you can work from your bathtub or from a bar in Rome. You can use leverage as a replacement for work. Well, okay, I was a little wrong about trading. One cannot work from a bathtub, but when done right, the job allows considerable free time. The same property applies to recording artists or movie actors. You let the sound engineers and projectionists do the work. There is no need to show up at every performance in order to perform. Similarly, a writer expends the same effort to attract one single reader as she would to capture several 100,000,000. J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, does not have to write each book again every time someone wants to read it. But this is not so for a baker. He needs to bake every single piece of bread in order to satisfy each additional customer. So the distinction between writer and baker, speculator and doctor, fraudster and prostitute, is a helpful way to look at the world of activities. It separates those professions in which one can add zeros of income with no greater labor from those in which one needs to add labor and time, both of which are in limited supply. In other words, those subjected to gravity. Beware the scalable. But why was the advice from my fellow student bad? If the advice was helpful, and it was, in creating a classification for ranking uncertainty in knowledge, it was a mistake as far as choices of profession went. It might have paid off for me, but only because I was lucky and happened to be in the right place at the right time, as the saying goes. If I myself had to give advice, I would recommend someone pick a profession that is not scalable. A scalable profession is good only if you are successful. They are more competitive, produce monstrous inequalities, and are far more random, with huge disparities between efforts and rewards. A few can take a large share of the pie, leaving others out entirely, at no fault of their own. One category of profession is driven by the mediocre, the average, and the middle of the road. In it, the mediocre is collectively consequential. The other has either giants or dwarves. More precisely, a very small number of giants and a huge number of dwarves. Let us see what is behind the formation of unexpected giants, the Black Swan formation. The advent of scalability. Consider the fate of Giacomo, an opera singer at the end of the 19th century, before sound recording was invented. Say he performs in a small and remote town in central Italy. He is shielded from those big egos at La Scala in Milan and other major opera houses. He feels safe as his vocal cords will always be in demand somewhere in the district. There is no way for him to export his singing, and there is no way for the big guns to export theirs and threaten his local franchise. It is not yet possible for him to store his work, so his presence is needed at every performance, just as a barber is still needed today for every haircut. So the total pie is evenly split, but only mildly so, much like your calorie consumption. It is cut in a few pieces and everyone has a share. The big guns have larger audiences and get more invitations than the small guy, but this is not too worrisome. Inequalities exist, but let us call them mild. There is no scalability yet, no way to double the largest in-person audience without having to sing twice. Now consider the effect of the first music recording, an invention that introduced a great deal of injustice. Our ability to reproduce and repeat performances allows me to listen on my laptop to hours of background music of the pianist Vladimir Horowitz, now extremely dead, performing Rachmaninoff's preludes, instead of to the local Russian emigre musician, still living, who is now reduced to giving piano lessons to generally untalented children for close to minimum wage. Horowitz, though dead, is putting the poor man out of business. I would rather listen to Vladimir Horowitz or Arthur Rubinstein for $10.99 a CD than pay $9.99 for one by some unknown but very talented graduate of the Juilliard School or the Prague Conservatory. If you ask me why I select Horowitz, I will answer that it is because of the order, rhythm, or passion, when in fact there are probably a legion of people I have never heard about and will never hear about, those who did not make it to the stage, but who might play just as well. Some people naively believe that the process of unfairness started with the gramophone, according to the logic that I just presented. I disagree. I am convinced that the process started much, much earlier, with our DNA, which stores information about ourselves and allows us to repeat our performance without our being there by spreading our genes down the generations. Evolution is scalable. The DNA that wins, whether by luck or survival advantage, will reproduce itself, like a best-selling book or a successful record, and become pervasive. Other DNA will vanish. Just consider the difference between us humans, excluding financial economists and businessmen, and other living beings on our planet. Furthermore, I believe that the big transition in social life came not with the gramophone, but when someone had the great but unjust idea to invent the alphabet, thus allowing us to store information and reproduce it. It accelerated further when another inventor had the even more dangerous and iniquitous notion of starting a printing press, thus promoting texts across boundaries and triggering what ultimately grew into a winner-take-all ecology. Now, what was so unjust about the spread of books? The alphabet allowed stories and ideas to be replicated with high fidelity and without limit, without any additional expenditure of energy on the author's part for the subsequent performances. He didn't even have to be alive for them. Death is often a good career move for an author. This implies that those who, for some reason, start getting some attention can quickly reach more minds than others and displace the competitors from the bookshelves. In the days of bards and troubadours, everyone had an audience. A storyteller, like a baker or a coppersmith, had a market, and the assurance that none from far away could dislodge him from his territory. Today, a few take almost everything, the rest next to nothing. By the same mechanism, the advent of the cinema displaced neighborhood actors, putting the small guys out of business. But there is a difference. In pursuits that have a technical component, like being a pianist or a brain surgeon, talent is easy to ascertain, with subjective opinion playing a relatively small part. The inequity comes when someone perceived as being marginally better gets the whole pie. In the arts, say the cinema, things are far more vicious. What we call talent generally comes from success, rather than its opposite. A great deal of empiricism has been done on the subject, most notably by Art Devaney, an insightful and original thinker who single-mindedly studied wild uncertainty in the movies. He showed that, sadly, much of what we ascribe to skills is an after-the-fact attribution. The movie makes the actor, he claims, and a large dose of non-linear luck makes the movie. The success of movies depends severely on contagions. Such contagions do not just apply to the movies. They seem to affect a wide range of cultural products. It is hard for us to accept that people do not fall in love with works of art only for their own sake, but also in order to feel that they belong to a community. By imitating, we get closer to others, that is, other imitators. It fights solitude. This discussion shows the difficulty in predicting outcomes in an environment of concentrated success. So for now, let us note that the division between professions can be used to understand the division between types of random variables. Let us go further into the issue of knowledge, of inference about the unknown, and the properties of the known. Scalability and globalization. Whenever you hear a snotty and frustrated European middlebrow presenting his stereotypes about Americans, he will often describe them as uncultured, unintellectual, and poor in math, because, unlike his peers, Americans are not into equation drills and the constructions middlebrows call high culture, like knowledge of Goethe's inspirational and central trip to Italy, or familiarity with a Delft school of painting. Yet the person making these statements is likely to be addicted to his iPod, wear blue jeans, and use Microsoft Word to jot down his cultural statements on his PC, with some Google searches here and there interrupting his composition. Well, it so happens that America is currently far, far more creative than these nations of museum-goers and equation solvers. It is also far more tolerant of bottom-up tinkering and undirected trial and error. And globalization has allowed the United States to specialize in the creative aspect of things, the production of concepts and ideas, that is, the scalable part of the products, and increasingly, by exporting jobs, separate the less scalable components and assign them to those happy to be paid by the hour. There is more money in designing a shoe than in actually making it. Nike, Dell, and Boeing can get paid for just thinking, organizing, and leveraging their know-how and ideas, while subcontracted factories in developing countries do the grunt work, and engineers in cultured and mathematical states do the non-creative technical grind. The American economy has leveraged itself heavily on the idea generation, which explains why losing manufacturing jobs can be coupled with a rising standard of living. Clearly, the drawback of a world economy where the payoff goes to ideas is higher inequality among the idea generators, together with a greater role for both opportunity and luck. But I will leave the socioeconomic discussion for part three and focus here on knowledge. Travels inside Mediocristan. This scalable, non-scalable distinction allows us to make a clear-cut differentiation between two varieties of uncertainties, two types of randomness. Let's play the following thought experiment. Assume that you round up 1,000 people randomly selected from the general population and have them stand next to one another in a stadium. You can even include Frenchmen, but please, not too many out of consideration for the others in the group. Mafia members, non-mafia members, and vegetarians. Imagine the heaviest person you can think of and add him to that sample. Assuming he weighs 3 times the average, between 400 and 500 pounds, he will rarely represent more than a very small fraction of the weight of the entire population. In this case, about 0.5%. You can get even more aggressive. If you picked the heaviest biologically possible human on the planet, who yet can still be called a human, he would not represent more than, say, 0.6% of the total, a very negligible increase. And if you had 10,000 persons, his contribution would be vanishingly small. In the utopian province of Mediocristan, particular events don't contribute much individually, only collectively. I can state the supreme law of Mediocristan as follows. When your sample is large, no single instance will significantly change the aggregate or the total. The largest observation will remain impressive, but eventually insignificant to the sum. I'll borrow another example from my friend Bruce Goldberg. Your caloric consumption. Look at how much you consume per year. If you are classified as human, close to 800,000 calories. No single day, not even Thanksgiving at your great aunt's, will represent a large share of that. Even if you tried to kill yourself by eating, that day's calories would not seriously affect your yearly consumption. Now, if I told you that it is possible to run into someone who weighs several thousand tons or stands several hundred miles tall, you would be perfectly justified in having my frontal lobe examined or in suggesting that I switch to science fiction writing. But you cannot so easily rule out extreme variations with a different brand of quantities, to which we turn next. The strange country of Extremistan. Consider by comparison the net worth of the 1,000 people you lined up in the stadium. Add to them the wealthiest person to be found on the planet, say Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft. Assume his net worth to be close to $80 billion, with the total capital of the others around a few million. How much of the total wealth would he represent? 99.9%? Indeed, all the others would represent no more than a rounding error for his net worth, the variation of his personal portfolio over the past second. For someone's weight to represent such a share, he would need to weigh 50 million pounds. Try it again with, say, book sales. Line up 1,000 authors, or people begging to get published, but calling themselves authors instead of waiters, and check their book sales. Then add the living writer who, currently, has the most readers. J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter series, with several hundred million books sold, will dwarf the remaining 1,000 authors with, say, collectively, a few hundred thousand readers at most. Try it also with academic citations, the mention of one academic by another academic in a formal publication, media references, income, company size, and so on. Let us call these social matters, as they are man-made as opposed to physical ones, like the size of waistlines. In extremistan, inequalities are such that one single observation can disproportionately impact the aggregate or the total. So while weight, height, and calorie consumption are from mediocristan, wealth is not. Almost all social matters are from extremistan. Another way to say it is that social quantities are informational, not physical. You cannot touch them. Money in a bank account is something important, but certainly not physical. As such, it can take any value without necessitating the expenditure of energy. It is just a number. Note that before the advent of modern technology, wars used to belong to mediocristan. It is hard to kill many people if you need to slaughter them one at a time. Today, with tools of mass destruction, all it takes is a button, a nutcase, or a small error to wipe out the planet. Look at the implication for the black swan. Extremistan can produce black swans, and does, since a few occurrences have had huge influences on history. This is the main idea of this book. Extremistan and knowledge. While this distinction between mediocristan and extremistan has severe ramifications for both social fairness and the dynamics of events, let us see its application to knowledge, which is where most of its value lies. If a Martian came to Earth and engaged in the business of measuring the heights of the denizens of this happy planet, he could safely stop at 100 humans to get a good picture of the average height. If you live in mediocristan, you can be comfortable with what you have measured, provided that you know for sure that it comes from mediocristan. You can also be comfortable with what you have learned from the data. The epistemological consequence is that with mediocristan-style randomness, it is not possible to have a black swan surprise such that a single event can dominate a phenomenon. Footnote: I emphasize possible because the chance of these occurrences is typically in the order of 1 in several trillion trillion, as close to impossible as it gets. Primo, the first 100 days should reveal all you need to know about the data. Secondo, even if you do have a surprise, as we saw in the case of the heaviest human, it would not be consequential. If you are dealing with quantities from extremistan, you will have trouble figuring out the average from any sample, since it can depend so much on one single observation. The idea is not more difficult than that. In extremistan, one unit can easily affect the total in a disproportionate way. In this world, you should always be suspicious of the knowledge you derive from data. This is a very simple test of uncertainty that allows you to distinguish between the two kinds of randomness. Capiche? What you can know from the data in mediocristan augments very rapidly with a supply of information. But knowledge in extremistan grows slowly and erratically with the addition of data, some of it extreme, possibly at an unknown rate. Wild and mild. If we follow my distinction of scalable versus non-scalable, we can see clear differences shaping up between mediocristan and extremistan. Here are a few examples. Matters that seem to belong to mediocristan, subjected to what we call type 1 randomness. Height, weight, calorie consumption, income for a baker, a small restaurant owner, a prostitute, or an orthodontist. Gambling profits, in the very special case, assuming a person goes to a casino and maintains a constant betting size. Car accidents, mortality rates, IQ as measured. matters that seem to belong to extremistan, subjected to what we call type 2 randomness. Wealth, income, book sales per author, book citations per author, name recognition as a celebrity, number of references on Google, populations of cities, uses of words in a vocabulary, numbers of speakers per language, damage caused by earthquakes, deaths in war, deaths from terrorist incidents, sizes of planets, sizes of companies, stock ownership, height between species, consider elephants and mice, financial markets, but your investment manager does not know it, commodity prices, inflation rates, economic data. The extremistan list is much longer than the prior one. The tyranny of the accident. Another way to rephrase the general distinction is as follows. Mediocristan is where we must endure the tyranny of the collective, the routine, the obvious, and the predicted. Extremistan is where we are subjected to the tyranny of the singular, the accidental, the unseen, and the unpredicted. As hard as you try, you will never lose a lot of weight in a single day. You need the collective effect of many days, weeks, even months. Likewise, if you work as a dentist, you will never get rich in a single day. But you can do very well over 30 years of motivated, diligent, disciplined, and regular attendance to teeth drilling sessions. If you are subject to extremistan-based speculation, however, you can gain or lose your fortune in a single minute. Table 1 summarizes the differences between the two dynamics, to which I will refer in the rest of the book. Confusing the left column with the right one can lead to dire, or extremely lucky, consequences. For Table 1, I will read you the two columns, contrasting each example of mediocristan versus extremistan. You can also find Table 1 in the PDF that accompanies this program. Table 1. Mediocristan, non-scalable. Extremistan, scalable. Mediocristan, mild or type 1 randomness. Extremistan, wild, even super wild, or type 2 randomness. Mediocristan, the most typical member is mediocre. Extremistan, the most typical is either giant or dwarf, i.e., there is no typical member. Mediocristan, winners get a small segment of the total pie. Extremistan, winner take almost all effects. Mediocristan, example, audience of an opera singer before the gramophone. Extremistan, today's audience for an artist. Mediocristan, more likely to be found in our ancestral environment. Extremistan, more likely to be found in our modern environment. Mediocristan, impervious to the black swan. Extremistan, vulnerable to the black swan. Mediocristan, subject to gravity. Extremistan, there are no physical constraints on what a number can be. Mediocristan, corresponds generally to physical quantities, i.e., height. Extremistan, corresponds to numbers, say, wealth. Mediocristan, as close to utopian equality as reality can spontaneously deliver. Extremist